Welcome to the South Cars Outreach Program. Join our training session in progress.
Welcome to the Outreach Program, sponsored by the South Coast Amateur Radio Service. This program has been established to help those wishing to learn more about our hobby and to further assist those wishing to upgrade license status. This will be an in-depth course pertaining to what one should know when studying for an extra class license. This course will be conducted with two sessions weekly, which will be at 7 p.m. Eastern, 2300 Zulu, each Tuesday and each Sunday evening. For those that are already licensed and wish either a refresher course or would just like to listen, please connect to our SCARS, that's S-C-A-R-S server, at either Echolink node number 96140 or IRLP node 9614, letting it drop. For those that are interested, please contact myself, Mike, at KD0CDQ via email at voip@voipnet.southcars.com to enroll in the class and be given directions as to the study material required and the manner that you will be connected into the course. The material being presented is formatted from data obtained from the ARRL and is simply being forwarded in a presentation format by SCARS. Should anyone take issue to some of the technical statements made, and in keeping with not interrupting the class and session, please convey your comments or suggestions to the outreach program, again at voip@voipnet.southcars.com. Dropping again. It should be mentioned that this course covers only the requirements pertaining to the United States Part 97 rules and does not include other requirements that may be found in foreign countries. Should any other country other than the United States wish to have their own licensing sessions on this server, please drop us an email, again, voip@voipnet.southcars.com. The session this evening will be recorded and posted on our website. Now, this is a different one. The recordings will be posted at www.voip.southcars.com. Letting it drop. Okay, here we go. Please note, for all of our class members and instructors, it's extremely important that we stay on the same page during these classes. The only question pool and copy thereof that should be used when participating in this class should be the one found posted on our website. Publications from other sources may or may not be current and should not be used during the sessions. Do we have any emergency or out of the ordinary business that needs to be handled before we start the session this evening? KD0CDQ, listening. Okay, Sunday night I was pretty rushed. I'd only been home from Texas for about a couple of hours. And so I want to thank Kathy. Thank Kathy so much for filling in for me on, Tuesday evening, because I was out of town. And my laptop, I didn't think visiting family would have been appropriate for me to be on the laptop during a class while we're supposed to be together. So at this point, I'm going to introduce you to Rebecca and James. Rebecca is KV4QX. James is KV4QY. They're both in Franklin, Georgia, and they will be the instructors this evening. So I don't know who's to start. I'm going to take a guess that it's Rebecca going to start off with the first question. So stand by, and I will be listing the question numbers in the text box as we go along so you can keep with us. Okay, Rebecca, over to you. KD0, over to you, Rebecca. KV4QX.
Oh, thank you, Mike. This is Rebecca, KB4QX, as you said. And tonight, I want to welcome everybody back, and I received the message that Richard wanted copies of the class emails that we do, and I've already got you added to that list, Richard, so Well, welcome to the group, and we're glad to have you. All right. Let's see. I take our first question here, and then we'll let Jim give comments on it. Tonight, we're starting off with Echo 3C, and this group has radio path horizon, less common propagation modes, propagation prediction techniques and modeling, space weather parameters, and amateur radio. The first question we're going to do is Echo 3C06. By how much does the VHF-UHF radio horizon distance exceed the geometric horizon? The correct answer for this one is by approximately 15% of the distance. I just wanted to say a little bit before I turn it to Jim. The radio horizon does not care if it's AM, FM, single sideband. It's just a measure of distance. It's not a guarantee of communications range. Your calculations that you do assume absolute optimum conditions, quality base stations, zero loss feed lines, properly installed connectors, perfectly flat terrain between the two antennas, perfectly circular antenna pattern, perfectly silent noise floor, etc. So the calculations you come up with for perfect conditions, and then you see what you got to deal with. And anyway, Mr. Rebecca, KB4QX, let me turn it over to Jim for comments on that question, and that was how much does the VHF-UHF radio horizon distance exceed the geometric horizon, and it's by approximately 15% of the distance.
This is a good question here, and it deals with all, like he said, it deals with all modes, so doesn't make any difference what the mode is. It's still going to be 15% greater than the horizon. Of course, they talk about all these conditions must be made perfect, but it's not necessarily so. You can have a something that reduces that, caused by noise or caused by some type of interference, and it's still a true statement. It is 15% beyond the physical horizon. So you just keep that 15 in mind, and you don't care what the direction is, and it's going to be right anyway. All right. Do we have any questions? All right. Miss Rebecca, if you will, number two.
All right. Thank you, Jim. This question is Echo 3, Charlie 1-2. Echo 3, Charlie 12. How does the maximum distance of ground wave propagation change when the signal frequency is increased? The correct answer is it decreases. And I'm going to turn this one over to Jim for any comments he's got, and then we'll see what kind of comments and questions that anybody out there may have. All right, Jim?
All right. Here we go again, you big old lad, they're asking us to try to throw a curve at us, I think. That's the idea. But you know, that it increases, and that's all you got to remember. And they're not asking you if any pursuing, they're not asking you if any math. Nothing, they just simply, frequency is increased, and distance is decreased. Now, I might add, in the passing, we've heard this much, but but where it's important that you get it. Please do not keep the alphanumeric expressions in mind, because they will be different. They will not be the same. So that is not a point to remember. It's remember something in the question that you'll also find in the answer, and generally you'll have it. If you find something in the answer that makes sense to you by the question, you got the two elements that you need. But by all means, do not keep that alphanumeric expression in memory, because it's going to be different on your test. Miss Omega?
All right, thank you, Jim. I want to see if there's any comments or questions from anybody else out there before we move to our next question. Okay, our third question for the night is Echo 3, Charlie 13, 13. What type of polarization is best for ground wave propagation? What type of polarization is best for ground wave propagation? And the correct answer for this one is vertical. And I'm going to turn this over to Jim for comments on here, and then we'll see what comments you have. This is KB4QX.
Yeah, again, we got another one of these questions that's tricky. So read it very, very closely. They're asking for vertical polarization here, because horizontal will get out further, but it starts skipping. And if you want to stay away from skip, which most of us are on VHF, UHF, we're interested in the signal to stay on the ground. So we want to run a vertical polarization, because that's the one that's more apt to stay on the ground than the horizontal polarization. Do we have anyone else with a question?
Okay, we're moving over to Echo 4A and looking at test equipment, analog and digital instruments, spectrum and network analyzers, antenna analyzers, oscilloscopes, RF measurements, computer-aided measurements. And the first question we're going to look at is Echo 4 Alpha 03. Which of the following test instruments is used to display stereo signals and or intermodulation distortion products in a single sideband transmitter? Our correct answer is a spectrum.
Oh. Spectrum analyzer. She ran into a little bit of problem there with that. But anyway, the spectrum analyzer. Well, this is, you got a lot of test equipment that they cover in here. But the best piece of equipment that you can get for a single sideband operation is a spectrum analyzer. You don't make no difference whether you look at modulation percentage or all kinds of measurements. The spectrum analyzer is still your A number one test equipment. In other words, you don't work on ham gear on single sideband, you better get your spectrum analyzer, because it's the one that'll tell you more about what's going on. And the rain just increased here, I noticed. Do we have any questions?
Six Victor with a comment, Jim.
Oh, you know, Six Victor, you're in there, Jordan.
Thank you, sir, and thank you, Rebecca. Just a quick comment. I've, through the years, found that the two most important pieces of equipment that I generally use, you know, other than a volt ohmmeter, is an oscilloscope and a spectrum analyzer. But I'll tell you, ladies and gentlemen, you won't find too many spectrum analyzers in ham shacks because they're very expensive. I used to work with Tektronix equipment, and I think our spectrum analyzer back in the 60s and 70s was $20,000 a copy, and I think right now it's probably three or four times that. But it's a wonderful instrument. It allows you to do just a whole bunch of things. You can dial it up to a 2-meter frequency, and you can look at a particular signal, and you can determine its deviation depending on what time base you pick. You can take a look at if there's any intermod products that are being produced, any spurious radiation. It's just gorgeous, but the dude is expensive. Back to you, Rebecca, KY6V. Thank you.
All right. And that's very true. The way we did it in my piece of woods, when I was coming up through here and would need a spectrum analyzer, which is not very often, but we had wood. In the Decatur end of it, Bramlin. That's not to say the only one in town, but certainly one in from me a mile. And it was kept at one fellow's house, and if you needed to go get it, use it, and then take it back. And that was because many of you had money invested. They went on to handle it. I didn't need one myself because it don't tell you much for a blind man. But I had an interest in it anyway. I had the same interest as everybody else did. And you're right, the old man, there's one thing that's come along that has improved as time went along, and that the volt ohmmeter. There was a time when you had to have a volt ohmmeter, and then you had to have a electronic volt ohmmeter. And that was a pain in the neck. Now you don't have to have that. Just the regular photometer will be sufficient because they run high impedance, and that's what you need. We have another question here in a little bit to come up with that, but it will be. Both old meters of today is certainly a whole lot better than the vacuum tube bolt meters that we used a long time ago. All right, Ms. Rebecca, back to you.
Thank you, Jim. And I want to thank you and Gordon for, and whoever else may have popped in there that I missed for taking care of that time lapse when I had a dog just said, I don't care how hard it's raining out there, I've got to go. So that's been taken care of, and my wet puppy's inside. All right. this next question we're going to tackle is Echo 4, Alpha 05. What might be an advantage of a digital versus an analog oscilloscope? Now, when it says what might be an advantage, it doesn't mean it's going to have all the advantages here, but let's see, we have an automatic amplitude and frequency numerical readout, have storage of traces for future reference, have manipulation of time-based after trace capture, and we have the awesome option of all of these choices are correct, and all of these choices are correct. So, that, as Jim pointed out last time, a lot of these that we're running into, all of them are correct, but they're not. When you have the option of all of these choices are correct, don't count on that being the correct answer, because quite often it's not. But when you do have that as an option, pay attention and to which ones are and which ones are not, so that way you don't get tripped up when you get your test on test day. Alright, let's see if Jill has any comments he wants to make on that one right quick. Oh, yes he does. Alright, Jill. Alright, yes, so all of those are correct. And here's the way you tell whether all of them is the correct answer. Look at two of them, or you look at the three that are there, and if you can find two of them that is right, then the third one will be right too, and so all of them are. They used to come out with A and B or some other that's correct number. They don't do that no more. They got down to single answer suffices. And if you find two of them correct, then the odds are that the other one is correct too, even though you may not recognize it. Alright, back to Rebecca.
Alright, if there's any comments or questions that need to be addressed before we pick up the next one. And this is Rebecca, KD4CX.
This is CDQ, just to turn a light bulb back on. If you're going for the extra class, you've been around the corner a few times, been around ham radio a while. But with these instruments like the spectrum analyzer, oscilloscopes, and antenna analyzers, if you're in a club or know a club, sometimes some people have not necessarily the spectrum, but they'll have the other instruments and they'll be glad to loan it to you. Be nice to buy them a cup of coffee and a donut for the use of it. Also at HamFest, things like HamFest, I've seen oscilloscopes and a lot of stuff laying around that if you're interested, you may be able to pick up some of the old equipment that isn't quite as brisk as today, but you may be usable. And the third thing is, I have not seen this, but maybe some radio stores, we call them the candy stores here, maybe some radio stores would rent or loan some of this equipment to you. I don't know. But I would love to have an antenna analyzer because I'm never sure if my antenna is doing the right thing. You just don't ever know. But HamFest, club members, and sometimes radio stores might have these things available for you. That's all I've got. KD0CVQ, back to listening.
Hey, we're on touchy situation here. Jim's radio just jumped off frequency, and I'm back on this handheld that went out on us a while ago, so we'll see what we get here. All right, let's see. Which of the following is good practice when using an oscilloscope probe? And our correct answer is keep the signal ground connection of the probe as short as possible. Thank you, Luke. Keep the signal ground connection of the probe as short as possible. While he's messing with that one over there, with cable length, it is necessary to consider your length of your cable. The longer the cable, often the lower the bandwidth.
However, it is still necessary to ensure that the length is sufficient to accommodate easy working. Sounds like Jim's got something going on over there. Jim, you got any comments you want to make?
Yes, ma'am. They jumped off me. Anyway, yes. Let me just comment on one thing. If you're constructing something or other that deals with RF, RF is a peculiar thing anyway. At the very best, it's still sometimes flaky. But to keep that ground lead as short as possible in any connection, whether it be a test connection or a permanent connection or what it is, you will do better. And you'll find truer readings and so forth if you keep that ground connection as short as possible. Because if it gets very long, it becomes an antenna itself, and that ain't good. So just keep that ground connection as short as possible. Don't make no difference whether it's test gear or permanent equipment gear. Do we have anybody with questions or comments?
Okay, also with this question, this is one of those all of these choices are correct questions, and obviously that was not the correct answer for this time. And that's just a thing to reinforce what we were saying earlier. All right, we're going to move over to section Echo 4. See? Measurement technique and limitations. Instrument accuracy. Performance limitations, probe, techniques to minimize errors, measurement of Q, instrument calibration, S parameters, and vector network analyzers. Well, this first one we're going to tackle is math. Don't let this one bum you out. There's also two others right here next to it. So with them having three questions that cover the same stuff, odds are you'll get one of them. Okay. I'm going to look at Echo 4, Bravo 3. If a frequency counter with a specified accuracy of plus or minus 1.0 parts per million reads 146,520,000 hertz, what is the most the actual frequency being measured could differ from the reading? Our correct answer is 146.52 hertz. On this question, on our copy of it, it is option C. Biggest thing with this is look at where your decimal point is. These other two questions that I have so right now, the only difference in these questions where it says with a specified accuracy of plus or minus, this one has 1.0 parts per million, that number will be slightly different. It will be a difference of where that decimal point is, and that's the biggest thing you need to watch out for. Now, I'm going to talk you through one way to work the problem, just in case you're not one of the fortunate people that can easily visualize what to do with this and move that decimal point quickly. Your study guide gives you another route to get to it. Okay, this one can easily be worked by dividing 146,520,000 by 1,000,000, and that we get the 1,000,000 from its 1,000,000 parts per million gives you your million, and then we're going to multiply that by your accuracy variance, and that's your 1.0 or your 0.1 or 10 or whatever your number happens to be. So in this case, it is 1.0. So with this one, you have 146,520,000 divided by 1 million equals 146.52. Then, of course, with the instructions I just gave you, take your 146.52 multiply it by 1, which is the exact same thing. So that's the biggest thing, is just get it broke down to a number you can look at, and then see what you need to do with your decimal point. This one is 1, so you don't need to move it. And any comments or questions on this question?
This is CDQ here. What I normally do with those, I remember the HZ hertz means hundreds to me. So I see the 146. The 146 is 100. And I put my decimal point behind it. Also, and it's a nice question, they give you a nice comma. Just replace the comma with the digit, with a dot. So that's how I remember that. HZ means hundreds. So I look 1, 2, 3 places. Put my dot. Well, I see the comma, just put the dot there. That's how I remember that one. If there's any other comments, go ahead. KD0CDQ listening.
Yeah, there's a lot of tricks and tips and tidbits that can be used, and each person is going to find your own way. The main thing is that you find one. You find a way to get to it, to get your answer and take it out. And looking at your hertz, you're working with hertz, you're going to be doing your calculations in hertz, whether you're actively pulling out paper and pencil or anything. So that already eliminates two of your options. It eliminates your megahertz and your kilohertz options. And then you can also look at, hey, I'm not changing the number. I'm working with ones and zeros here. I'm not changing my number. So you're looking at 165.2 or 146.52, and that narrows it down even further. So this one's actually not that bad. I don't have the other two questions pulled up, but I know the next two questions were also with the same set of numbers here, but the answers would vary some. Find a way to recall where your answer correctly is. And with this one, the biggest thing is watch the placement of the decimal point if you're going to do the calculations themselves.
6, Victor.
Go ahead, Gordon.
Yeah, I really don't want to confuse this issue too much because there's a lot of ways you can get to Rome. A lot of streets, a lot of avenues, so on. I'll tell you a trick that I use, Rebecca, and some of the students might find it easy for them. When you're working formulas of this magnitude, just reduce the equation to start with. Now, let me give you an example of a side of what we're talking with this 2-meter frequency. If you're determining wavelength, wavelength is actually 300,000,000 divided by the frequency, okay? So you have to put in, if you're talking 146.52, you've got to put in 300 million with all of those zeros. And then you got to put 146.52000 for the division item to come up with the answer. I simply just pick 300. I drop all of the zeros. That's in the millions. I take the 146 and use that as the divider. Now, I'm talking wavelength in this particular situation. And you'll get the answer immediately. You're not fooling around with the extra baggage. In this case, 146.5200, just put in 146.520 and divide that by the parts per million, which in this case is 1 million, so it's 0.001, and you'll come up with 146.52. Just another way to get to Rome. KY6V. Go ahead, Rebecca.
Thank you, Gordon. And as you said, it's just another route to get there. And there are a lot of good ways to do it. The main thing is find something that works for you. All right. Our next question is Echo 4 Bravo 08. What of the following is a characteristic of a good DC voltmeter? And I'm going to read this one out a little bit. The high reluctance input, the low reluctance input, high impedance input, low impedance input. Something to make it look confusing. The correct answer is your high impedance input. Jim referred to that earlier. And if we are to increase the meter input impedance, we would diminish its current draw or load on the circuit under test, and consequently improve its measurement accuracy. He said, you have any comments you want to make, Jim? All right, he said that's the comment he wanted to make. Any other comments or questions? Okay. What happens if a dip meter is too tightly coupled to a tuned circuit being checked? Correct answer is a less accurate reading result. And when I was doing some reading on this, I already figured out that some reason when you're too tightly coupling something together and it's not giving you your reading, you've got it pinched off and crimped off. And I did some further reading on that. It's actually very interesting. Jim, you got comments you want to make on this one? All right.
Man, there we go. I'm on my topic now. We swapped the radios all over the place. On this one, once again, what I was saying too earlier, if you get it too closely coupled, the impedance is low, and that means that your system is going to be swamped, and therefore the reading will be not correct, because you've got more reading on the circuit. I mean, you got more load on the circuit. So you do not want a low impedance meter. You want a high impedance meter. So, and there's seven low ones out there that I know of right now. It's about everything's high impedance. But if you run across one that's low impedance, then that will not be a good meter to test the circuit with, because it swamps the circuit. And that's no good at all. So you will want a high impedance meter. Anyone else with any questions or comments?
I've got one, Jim. Generally, the dip meter is a handheld box with a plug-in coil sticking out one end and a calibrated frequency dial. To measure the resonant frequency of a tuned circuit, hold the dip meter so that the circuit coil couples to the dip meter coil, either side by side or end to end. Slowly tune the dip meter through the frequency range until you see the meter dip. You see the level just drop down a little bit. Then you separate the coupling. You give it a little space there between the coupling and the coils, just to get it just a little bit further apart until that dip is just noticeable. That's where you're going to find your most accurate measurement for your and that's part of what Jim was trying to refer to, getting too much load on it. If you've already got a 10 pound sack of flour on your scales and you add a quarter of a cup, you're not going to find that quarter of a cup. But if you're starting with it at zero, you'll pick up on that quarter cup of flour. You just add to the scale. And that's basically what we're doing here. And when you look at it that way, it made a whole lot more sense in my head. All right, any other comments or questions? Okay. We're moving on to Echo 4C. The receiver performance characteristics, phase noise floor, image rejection, MDF, signal-to-noise ratio, selectivity, effects of SDR receiver, non-linearity. And we're going to look at what is the term for the blocking of one FM phone signal by another stronger FM phone signal. What is the term for the blocking of one FM phone signal by another stronger FM phone signal? And our correct answer is capture effect.
Yeah, this capture effect, this is KB4QF, by the way. This capture effect, that's a real fancy way of saying swamp. That's what it means. You put a strong, put a signal out there, and then you put one over it that is stronger than the first one. That second signal is going to swamp the first one. That's what's going to happen to it. So, that's just a plain, and the idea enough that we can talk about an FM signal. God, what are you talking about? It's the same thing on sideband, AM, anything else. You got one that's stronger than the other one. The stronger one's going to be what comes through. So, they'll try to fox out on it, but it's simple. So, keep in mind, this is not a real complicated question here, or it's best in any case. If you got one stronger than the first one, the second one is going to take over in any mode. So, keep that in mind. Do we have any questions or comments on this?
All right. And just looking at the term here, capture effect. For the term, capture effect is defined as the complete suppression of the weaker signal at the receiver limiter, if it's got one, where the weaker signal is not amplified but attenuated. Interestingly enough, when both signals are nearly equal in strength or are fading independently, the receiver may switch from one signal to the other, and you'll get a picket sensing effect from that. All right, that was different there. Interesting things going on here. All right, any other comments before we pick up our next question? All right, we're on good time here. We're just past quarter till, and we got this question and one more left. All right, Echo 4C12. What is an undesirable effect of using too wide a filter bandwidth in the IF section of a receiver? What is an undesirable effect of using too wide a filter bandwidth in the IF section of the receiver? And Jim's over there saying he's kicking up noise. Yep, answer is undesired signals may be heard. Undesirable effect using too wide a filter. Your answer is undesired signals may be heard. It's kicking up noise. All right, I think that's got it covered there. You got anything else for Jim? He said that took care of that one right quick. All right, and our last question, Echo 4C.
see landscape. Which of the following is caused by missing codes in an SDR receiver's analog to digital converter? Which of the following is caused by missing codes in an SDR receiver's analog to digital converter? And the answer is distortion. And I looked at it and I said, where in the heck am I going to be finding this? This doesn't make a bit of sense to me. I looked at it and I'm like, oh, all right, it's something we use all the time. Software-defined radio. It's a radio communication system where components that have been typically implemented in hardware, such as your mixers, filters, amplifiers, your modulators, demodulators, detectors. A lot of this equipment you hear that these guys have been using for years past that you don't seem to be needing to pull up and play with unless you're going to go with stupid set of toys. Well, instead, doing the same thing through means of software on a personal computer or some other embedded system. So while the concept of SDR is not new, the rapidly evolving capabilities of digital electronics render practical many processes that used to be only theoretically possible. All right. Any comments or questions? And then we'll call it a night. This is Rebecca, KB4QX.
Now, we got a moment there. This digital equipment, we got more of it than we think of, really. I was looking around here when this question come up, and I believe every damn thing in my house is now is in this category. It's focus and the ATF rig and all the rest stuff. It's sitting in the category of that. And the rig is programmed to operate under these conditions. But later on, and it happened in my 2000, later on they come out with a more efficient set of parameters, and they put the new parameters in the radio, made a world of difference in that radio. They didn't change anything in the radio. It just made a software change. So this question right here, this concept here, is quite normally used. In fact, it's more apt to be used than it is not to be used in today's radios. And this thing is asking the question, you got two stages of the radio. Well, you might have more than two, but you got two of these. And one of them is taken over from the other one. In other words, you got a system that's just like the question before described. And in this case, your receiver or a transmitter, either one, where you got stages that are not balanced. Then you're going to come out with distortion. And it's just caused by the one signal being stronger than the other signal. And so it's very commonly used stuff nowadays. So watch this one now. When it gets into that, it sounds like it It's old, but it's been around since about the 520 or just earlier than that. I believe PS-99 is where it started, but anyway, it's been back a long time anyway. Go ahead, Miss.
This is Rebecca KB4QX, and that's got our questions for tonight, and it sounds like our storm is fading on out of here, so that time is...
Alright, so that was working out well, and we'll call it a night. I'll get the emails sent out, and we'll catch you later. Mike, we're going to turn it over to you, buddy, and this has been an interesting night. This is KB4QA. KB4QA. Good night, good evening.
Thank you so much, Rebecca and James, for being our instructors this past Sunday night and now Tuesday night. Thank you so much. We can't extend enough thanks to you. We appreciate your preparation time. Appreciate your time on the air trying to explain some of these things to us. Well, as you know, we're going to continue up the East Coast here, it looks like. We had Gordon and Kathy in Florida. They did the first two classes. Then we moved now to Franklin, Georgia, for Rebecca and James. Now we're going to move on up the coast next time. On Sunday, we're going to have Roger, who is a W4RFJ in Ridley Park, Pennsylvania. So Roger will be coming to us from Pennsylvania, and along with him will be George. George is N-O-7-O, and he's in Nottingham, Maryland. So we're going to have Pennsylvania and Maryland on next Sunday and next Tuesday. And then we'll follow up from there, keeping on moving around the country, because we got hams all over. Are there any questions pertaining to anything covered tonight that you'd want more explanation? I know Gordon's listening in case there's something really in-depth we have to answer. So please, if anyone has a question, please come aboard with it now. This is KD0CDQ in Olathe, Kansas, listening. Okay, I guess you all know the routine. We have to have the radios silent while Gordon cuts off his recordings. So let's give it a few moments so Gordon can cut off his recordings, and I will do the same here. So if we all go quiet for a few minutes so he can do this. Standing by.
This has been the South Cars Outreach Program. Join us again next time for another in-hour series of training sessions for amateur radio operators. Goodbye for now.